Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Since 1984, the Vermont Folklife Center has been collecting recorded interviews and photographs that tell the stories of Vermonters to understand the cultural and social fabric of Vermont's diverse communities. The methods they've used to capture and tell these stories have adapted with the technology and trends of the times. The center has recently published two books that share stories in comic form. Today, we're going to discuss Turner family stories from enslavement in Virginia to freedom in Vermont. And we've got the editors of the book with us. Joining me now is the founder of the Vermont Folklife Center and a member of the Board of Trustees, Jane Beck. Jane, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. And Andy Kolovas is the center's associate director and archivist. Andy, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Rick.
Welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for our guests or if you knew Daisy Turner, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Jane, big question to start you off with. Who was Daisy Turner?
She was an amazing woman who born in 1883. I did not meet her until she was 100 years old. Mm. And she was born of two enslaved parents and maintained her father's story for four generations and over a span of two centuries. And she told me this story over a period of 2 years.
Mm. And tell us how and how you went about meeting Daisy Turner in the first place.
Well, Margaret MacArthur, the singer, musician that people probably knew well, first sent me a clipping about her. And said she had always meant to go see her, but had never gotten around to it, and I should definitely go because she had all kinds of songs and wonderful stories. And she also sent me a clipping about her, and I knew as I read it that I wanted to...
Oh, do we still have Jane? We lost her? Okay. Well, Andy, we'll get back to that story with Jane, but Jane had written a book about Daisy Turner. There's a documentary. So why a comic book on some of her stories?
Well, I mean, a couple of reasons. One, I am an unapologetic comic nerd, and the opportunity to create some comics based on stuff from the Folklife Center's collection was really exciting to me. Two, there's been a real big growth of interest in nonfiction comics. Particularly in YA, in young adult reading, but in general, you know. So it seemed to us as an opportunity to bring Daisy's stories to a new audience. Jane's book is an incredibly readable scholarly book, but not everybody's going to pick up a book like that. And the hope is that with the comics, they could go to the book and then maybe discover some of the older media that the Folklife Center created, like the radio documentary, which won a Peabody Award, by the way.
Wow.
And the video that Jane put together back in the late 80s and early 90s.
So how did you go about, you know, selecting the artists for the comic book?
Well, the other project, the other book you mentioned, The Most Costly Journey, is an anthology of comics about migrant workers' stories. And I worked on that with a group of people associated with the Open Door Clinic. And through that and through some other projects we've been doing, we've done COVID put the kibosh on it, but for the last several years, we did a kind of a comics conference with UVM and also one on our own. I got to know a lot of cartoonists in Vermont. So in this case, we were interested in a bunch of things, primarily cartoonists with ties to New England, cartoonists of color, women cartoonists, and people who I knew did historical work. So that was kind of the broad umbrella we were looking under. And I just connected with people who I knew, who I respected, or who I wanted to know. through doing the project.
Mm. I think we have Jane back. Jane, sorry we lost you as you were telling us meeting how you went about meeting Daisy Turner. But what were your impressions when you finally got to sit down and talk to Daisy Turner?
I was just blown away by her ability to tell a story, and she brings you right into the scene that she is talking about, and she was a master storyteller.
Mm. So how did you, you know, winnow down from all the stories that were in your book, to figure out which ones would be best to put in this comic book about her life?
Well, that was really Andy who chose the stories. They were stories she told extremely well, mm-hmm. and there are many more that are just as strong, but these seem to sum up her father's life and hers probably in the best way.
What made her such a great storyteller, Jane?
Well, she was able to, she think of her as 100, but she had a cane. She would use the cane to indicate a task. She would use facial expressions. Her voice would rise and fall. She'd get angry. She'd get emotional. She had the range of emotions in telling a story that brought you right into it.
Mm. Andy, I'm going to flip that question about winnowing down all those great stories and, how you determine which ones wound up in this book about the family, Turner family stories.
Sure. Well, all the cartoonists who were part of the project got kind of a pack of Daisy stuff. So they got a copy of the film and the audio series. They got a copy of Jane's book. And I gave them access to digital copies of all sorts of photos for reference. And I basically said, here, listen to this stuff. Maybe start with the radio series because it's curated and easy to access, and see what jumps out at you. I was curious because I sort of wondered where people would go. I'm not surprised. One of the cartoonists, Joel Gill, who does a lot of history comics about African-American history, I figured that Joel would probably want to do the story he did, knowing the sort of work Joel does. And with Merrick Bennett, who has done his major work, ongoing one, is adapting a Civil War diary from his hometown in Henniker, New Hampshire, the Civil War diary of Freeman Colby, I sort of thought that Merrick would gravitate towards the kind of stories he gravitated towards. And that's the one that opens with the end of the Civil War.
Well, Andy, what is it that you find most compelling about Daisy Turner?
I mean, as a folklorist, and it's many of the same things that attracted Jane. It's both the nature of the stories she tells and the way she tells them. And you mentioned that you're going to play some audio of her, which I think is wonderful because, it's one thing to read Daisy's stories. It's another thing to hear her say them. So that kind of combination of this incredible back knowledge, this real dedication to preserving a family story, her memory, which is just mind blowing because I can't remember where I put my keys, and her expertise as a storyteller.
Well, let's hear Daisy's voice. And this is from the documentary Journey's End. It's a powerful moment that she describes about her father. So let's play this.
When father saw this man crying, wiping his eyes, this white man, he felt sad. And then they saw Papa wiping his eyes, and they felt sad, too. They were sad. So then they went over and asked my father if he knew of any more of the ex-slave boys strong like him that would like to come up in the country and work. They told my father what a healthy place Grafton was. And that his father said that. Well, what started the word? That rung a bell right in him, just like that. When he said what a healthy place Grafton was. So then Father says, why did you say such a healthy place? And so then they told them, it was cold and snow and all, and then Father told them that his wife was dying with old-fashioned consumption, and they hadn't given him only the day to think. So they said, you don't mean it. So they said, we'll pray. That's why I know there's power in prayer. The Father said they prayed right there in the North Station. And he had been so faithful and believed in my Father that he said that this warm wave just come over him there, and he knew. And so he said that he said to them, I won't go now, because he couldn't go right off from his work and everything. But he says, you'll come back tomorrow morning, and I'll go with you. And my boss from Maine will be with me. I can get him. And we will go to the bank. And I'm sure they will let you have the money.
Mm. Jane, what a powerful moment bonding these men from Grafton, Vermont, and Alec Turner, this former slave. How was Alec Turner welcomed when he came to Grafton?
He liked it immediately, right from the beginning. However, the men told him that he wouldn't be able to earn enough to put salt in his bread. And so, in those days, salt was expensive. And, so he found that most Vermonters had a 3.5-pound axe, and he got someone to make him a 4-pound axe so he could cut considerably more lumber. He was a powerful man. And so people respected his strength. And that, I think, along with his storytelling ability and his singing, drew people to him.
He sounds like Vermont's Paul Bunyan when you tell it. And tell us the story about the barrel of flour.
Well, that was on a bet. And he would help the storekeeper unload wagons. And he asked if he could buy 10 pounds of flour to take home. And the storekeeper said, well, if you can carry a barrel of flour home 3 miles up Turner Hill, you can have it. And he said, well, you'll lose your bet because I'll do it. And he did. And the men followed him. And once they got up to the shanty that he lived in at that point, they all indulged in a celebratory drink.
A lovely story.
And he became known as the strongest man in Grafton.
Yeah. Andy, what was the process of converting these incredible family stories that reach back to slavery into these cartoon vignettes?
Okay, well, as I mentioned, we shared content with people, you know, audio, transcripts, video, books, and photos, and said, pick what works for you. You know, trusting the cartoonists that we work with, the ones we knew had good experience, and thought, let's see what they come up with. So the process generally is that they would go through it, they would pick a story, we'd have a discussion about it, then they'd create what are called thumbnails, basically like a rough breakdown of how they think the story should go. And then from there, they do the final art. And for most of the stories, they all worked independently. For that linking story, so there are four stories in the book. One is a longer account of Alec leaving the South after the Civil War, and that scene that you played the audio from is depicted, ultimately when he decides to move to Grafton. The next story picks up with his arrival in Grafton and tells various stories of Alec in Grafton, and also the Barrel of Flour story. We also wanted to have Daisy stories too. Mm-hmm. There are two stories about Alec and two about Daisy. One about Daisy deals with a lawsuit, and we can talk more about that in detail if you want. The other is an account of a vision she had of her father while she was working in Boston, because Daisy worked in the Boston area for many years, calling her home to help, so where she went home to help. So those four stories were basically done by the artists, who received the material, made a decision, created some drafts, and we went back and forth and then finalized everything. There's one other story that's done by Ezra Veach, who grew up in Grafton and remembers Daisy as a kid. Ezra's my age. I'm 50. That story is a fictionalized account of Ezra's engagement with Daisy with a friend of Ezra's named Luca. The actual story was pretty small because Daisy had a local reputation for being kind of cranky. Mm-hmm. So the actual story is Ezra, who's still an old car guy to this day, and Luca were riding their bikes, and Daisy had a junk car in the yard that Ezra and Luca were fascinated by. They went to check it out, and Daisy started shouting at them, telling them to give it away. So using that story as a starting point, we worked with Ezra to kind of create this, a way to link all four of the other stories together. Mm-hmm. So in this version, Ezra and Luca approach the car, and instead of driving them off, Daisy calls them up to her porch and starts telling them the stories in the book.
Yeah,
and with that one, Jane and I went back and forth with Ezra.
I love it. Jane, do you remember the first story that Daisy told you?
The first day, you know, she told me a pile of stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were first in Virginia, and then we were in New Orleans, and I couldn't make head or tail of the scope. I mean, you know, they ran together, and I knew it was a history of her family, but I couldn't get my hands around it. I guess the first day she spent a lot of time on the plantation, and, you know, you don't know where it is, and you're sort of dropped in. And so it took me a while, and one of the first stories, of course, she told me was one that isn't in the book, but one that was important to her, was when she had to take a black doll in a school pageant, and she didn't want to be singled out to take the black doll.
Mm-hmm. At what point were you able to convince her to be able to record or video her telling the stories?
Fairly soon. I think, you know, one or two trips down. And she would sing, and then she would turn to me and say, "Well, you should have your recorder on." And, you know, and then later on she would, when we did do it, she would forget that I had the recorder on, and she would say, "Okay, turn on your recorder." And I would say, "Well, it's on." So the recorder was, once it was introduced, it was not a big deal at all for her.
Yeah.
The thing that I really worried about was whether we were going to be able to videotape her. And finally, we were.
That's great.
That took longer.
Andy, you kind of teased us about the incredible story of the court case in Boston that involved Daisy Turner. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure, just the story itself. So Daisy got into a relationship with a man who was an interesting character in himself, because it was that transition from horsepower to combustion engine. So he dealt with horse tack and with cars. And Daisy met her. They began a relationship. He was married at the time, and eventually brought Daisy into the house as his maid, because he was kind of bad that way, while his wife was dying. Then in that process, had essentially promised Daisy that they would be married. His wife died. Daisy was anticipating getting married. She was called home for some stuff, and then returned to discover that he had married someone else. So Daisy, being Daisy, wasn't going to take that lying down, and she filed suit against him for breach of promise. And the key here is this is a black woman suing a white man in early 20th century Massachusetts. And she didn't win on all the accounts, but she did win on some, you know, and her statement is, "I am vindicated." Mm. You know, it was just a remarkable story. And that's an interesting one for the book, too, because it was originally started by a cartoonist named Robin Smith, who just, because of other responsibilities, couldn't finish it. So Joel Gill, who's also a professor of art and cartooning, recommended one of his former students, Francis Bordello, who took it up and finished it.
A really captivating story. Jane, what do you hope people will take from the book, Turner Family Stories?
Well, I would hope that it would have find another readership, because I think the family story is really remarkable. You very seldom hear of a story that goes from West Africa through the Middle Passage, through slavery, and freedom. And it's a remarkable, remarkable story, and it has been kept alive really through storytelling. And perhaps that goes back to the tradition of the West African griot, mm-hmm. who was a major storyteller in Africa.
Andy, we've got about a minute left. I do want to bring up something we mentioned earlier. Folklife Center has produced another comic called The Most Costly Journey. So what will people find in that book?
So that project was done with the Open Door Clinic, which is a free clinic in Middlebury that provides a lot of health care to Latin American migrant workers on dairy farms. And the project emerged when one of the nurses noticed that all these guys, because it was then mostly guys, were having all these ailments, but that they couldn't link to any physical illness. And they sort of realized these guys are having mental health issues. They're having problems due to trauma, border crossings, exhaustion, inability to communicate, isolation. So she hit upon the idea of creating comics as an outreach tool, because for a lot of these guys, the notion of mental health care and reaching out was alien, you know. So she figured, if I could get these guys to talk and then I can create comics, we can give the comics out to the workers. So this collection is the English language collection, because the comics were distributed in Spanish originally for an English language readership. So you're going to see a whole bunch of stories about people's experience crossing the border, and also about what it's like to be here as a worker on a farm, and the struggles you have and the triumphs you have and how you make a life. The Spanish version, we're hoping to do a Kickstarter for it this fall, if not early winter. So there will be a Spanish version coming out soon, too.
Andy Kolovis is the Folklife Center's Associate Director and Archivist. Jane Beck is the founder of the Vermont Folklife Center and is on the Board of Trustees. And both of them edited Turner Family Stories from Enslavement in Virginia to Freedom in Vermont. You can learn more at VermontFolklifeCenter.org. Jane and Andy, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you, Rick.
Great, compelling stories. All right, CBS News is up next. Then we open up the phones, and we've got several things to clear up from yesterday's show. Coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, and that's followed by The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table, and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest, and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. Okay, let's open up the phones, see where it takes us today. Got wild yesterday. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Just as we finished up our conversation about the Turner family and Vermont Folklife Center, Beth wrote in. She said, just tuned in and recognized Daisy Turner's voice. I used the video of Daisy sharing her stories when I taught middle school humanities and focused on oral histories of Vermonters. Thank you, Folklife Center. Daisy's and other stories are so engrossing. I haven't taught middle school in years, but I'm happy to learn about this book. Thank you. Great note from you, Beth. Thanks for listening. All right. So yesterday, Director of Operations and Audio Guru Charlotte Strasser opened up a Pandora's box of fun, and we played a couple audio cuts that were a mystery to her. And one was a renewal of wedding vows that were saved on reel-to-reel tape. The vows took place in 1966 between Martin and Margaret. That's all she knew. But who were they? Why did they have a recording, or why did we have a recording of this blessed event? Corinne Cooper, who is the president of the Berlin Historical Society, used her brilliant skills to find that the celebrants were Martin and Margaret Lamson on the occasion of their 25th wedding anniversary. And then it was later learned that our own Kenley Squire was the ring bearer when they were first married in 1941. And we had another mystery cut. And Danny, let's hear some of that now.
Hello there, neighbor. how do you feel about prohibition?
As a school teacher, I'm opposed to it, naturally. I've worked all my life with children, and I'm against anything harmful to them. I remember the wild automobile rides and the flasks that some boys thought were smart. Why did they act that way? Because they saw their elders violating the so-called prohibition law. I don't think parents want to expose their children to the evils of prohibition again. I certainly don't.
Remember, parents, legal dealers don't sell to minors. The bootlegger sells to anybody who has the price. Also remember, prohibition...
All right, so this was found on vinyl, pressed here at WDEV. And we wondered if this was an ad that was created in response to a temperance movement that maybe came about sometime after Prohibition was repealed in 1931. So our friend Wade from East Corinth said that we should get in the mood with Rum Runner, the song Rum Runner by the Billy Hazen Boys. Tip of the cap to Mary, who found it for us. And music, Danny, please, let's get in the mood. That's the Billy Hazen Boys singing Rum Runner. And Wade, you are correct. That does get us in the mood for Prohibition or the rum running that went on in Prohibition. Of course, you can read some of the tales that happened in the NEK during that time in some of the books by Howard Frank Mosier, which are absolute classics. But again, we heard from my new bestie, Corinne Cooper, who sent various newspaper clippings from 1952 through 1958, and they were referencing the work of the Citizens Temperance League. And we really need to have Corinne Cooper on retainer here. But let me read some of the information that she has uncovered, and just bear with me here. I've pulled out some of the information from these news stories that she sent along. This is from 1958, the Springfield Reporter. It says, according to the liquor people themselves, there is vastly more bootlegging now than ever before. This is in 1958, so well after Prohibition. Making liquor readily available has not done away with liquor evils. Instead, it has multiplied them. It has increase the number of drunkards, alcoholics, and broken homes. And especially it is teaching our youth to drink illegally, and it is causing most of the destruction and death on our highways. We believe that our laws should recognize the scientific fact that a person is under the influence if he has been drinking at all. We should not permit any liquor on our highways, and to do that, we must make sobriety again as popular as it was before national prohibition. We must again come to our senses and realize that that total abstinence is, in our present age of power and speed, more important than ever. All right, that was from 1958. I'm going to skip that one. And 1954, this is St. Albans Messenger. The headline was Temperance Preacher on Coast to Coast Broadcast, November 7th. So Reverend Sam Morris of San Antonio, Texas, has scheduled a 30-minute broadcast over the Coast to Coast facilities of NBC for November 7th. He will speak on the subject, Liquor, A Curse to America. This will be the first time since repeal of national prohibition that a national network has sold time for public discussion of the highly controversial subject of prohibition. It culminates a 15-year struggle on the part of the National Temperance Council, spearheaded by Mr. Morris, to get on the networks. So there was indeed, through the 50s, a move to reignite prohibition. There was a temperance movement. This is from 1952. And again, back to the Springfield Reporter. And again, reading just part of it, but it says, this year there is in Springfield a campaign underway to do away with the sale of alcoholic beverages. The campaign is one based on the idea that temperance can be induced by removing from public sight and sale all alcoholic beverages. Those who lived during the years of that noble experiment known as Prohibition can well remember how well-meaning temperance groups foisted on the nation a law outlawing alcoholic beverages, which did nothing but lay the foundation for corruption in both private and public life, which today still stains our national picture. So we're not really sure exactly what the clip was that Charlotte found, but it does sound like it might have been in response to what was happening in the 50s, these temperance movements. The other thing that's kind of eerie in what you're hearing from the 1950s is not unlike arguments pro and con for the legalization of marijuana that we've heard over the last few years here in Vermont. So, you know, things like impairment and driving. So it's very interesting to flash back, you know, what's old is new again in a way. And my thanks to Charlotte Strasser, first of all, for finding that clip. We'd still like to know more if you're aware of what that bit of audio might have been. We'd love to know, but we're guessing from some of this that it's possible that it was in response to some new temperance ideas going on in the 50s. I received an email from Monique in Williamstown this weekend, and it read, I recently heard Tom Beardsley talking about the unusual items on the Trading Post over the years. I thought it might be fun as part of the 90th celebration to gather listeners' memories of the most unusual things they have bought, sold, heard on the Trading Post. Tom mentioned a helicopter, which I missed. My most unusual was hearing a shout-out for a used utility pole, which wasn't that long ago. You just never know what you're going to get. That is so true. I'm going to flip ahead here. Craig Durham, who has done mornings for us through the summer, and he'll pop back in and out. He wondered what he stepped in when on his first day of the Trading Post, someone was selling chicken manure. That's not the word that Craig used, but he's like, what? Is this real? Yes, it is, Craig. Yes, it is. All right, so I'd love to get this started and keep this brilliant idea of Monique's rolling, this idea, through the 90th. You can always shoot me an email with something you've heard. Heck, it might be something kooky that you listed or actually bought. You can call us at 244-1777. 877-291-8255. I did ask Beards about the helicopter, and here's what he said. He heard the story from both Ken Squire and Rusty Parker, but he was not working that day, wasn't taking calls when it actually happened, he being Tom. So we're going to have to get Kenley maybe to tell the story sometime. Maybe he remembers exactly who sold the helicopter. I also heard, I think, from Dana Jewell said he believed the helicopter actually did indeed sell. Amazing. All right. In the past months, here are some items that have been up for sale on the Trading Post. An air hockey table, which was free. As a matter of fact, we got a call yesterday from Ian who wanted the number of the person who had that air hockey table. So I think that might be having a new home soon. There was an electric organ, too, that was free. You had to come move it. It was pretty heavy. But I think someone over like Moncton Way or Huntington had that several months ago. There's been Barbie dolls. This was one of my favorites. A pile of old air-cooled VW parts and pieces. And what something makes me think that someone else needed that and probably jumped on it. An old clawfoot bathtub, a Western saddle, and then pullets, roosters, chicks, piglets, a Jersey heifer, a bucking goat, a bird dog. Yes, indeed, all been offered just recently on the Trading Post. I don't even know how far back the Trading Post goes. There must be thousands of items that have been offered through the years that you have heard listening here on WDEV. I was on the morning we set, well, at least I'm saying we set the record for the highest priced Trading Post item. It was a $329,000 home up on Beckley Hill in North Barry. I'm assuming in this market it has indeed sold. I'm not sure if through the Trading Post or through other real estate means, but that was offered for sale here on the Trading Post. Now, I always like the looking fors, and when it happens, I always think, good luck, right? Here's, you're looking for this, and it sounds just, I don't know, too rare that you're going to find something. But someone was looking for a barn fan, and it had to spin, I think, counterclockwise. It had to spin one way or the other. It was very specific. And somebody called a few days later and said, hey, can I get that guy's number? I have the barn fan he needs. Now, a barn was being taken down maybe 6 years before, and the person who called in decided, yeah, I need to keep that. And he had it under his workbench for the past 6 years and did nothing with it. And then all of a sudden he's listening to the Trading Post and somebody says, hey, I really need this barn fan that spins this way. And the guy says, there it is. Been keeping it for you under my workbench for the last 6 years. That is the beauty of, the Trading Post. Let's see. Another one, a very specific, just the bed, very specific, make, model, year of an old truck. And again, it was so specific. You think there's no way someone would have this. Don't worry. A week later, someone called in, got the number and, hooked that person up with the bed of an old truck from that specific make, model and year. Let's see. Others remembered a cemetery plot and, let's call it a physical liaison with a number of different people, if you know what I mean. I'm not sure if that was for sale or was in the looking for category. But I did, poke Dana Jewell and he wrote back and this is what he said. He said a guy called saying he just inherited his grandmother's house in Burlington to cover the maintenance taxes, et cetera. He decided to turn it into a brothel. He was hiring and taking reservations. I told him the Trading Post is not for business, nor personal ads, and suggested he contact 7 days instead. The cemetery plot story is also true. I think Mike Carey took a call about a helicopter that was actually sold on the Trading Post. And now here's a great story from Dana. He says, I have covertly sold several vehicles and other items on the Trading Post. One guy called looking for a 1957 Chevy Barbie car for his daughter. I'm not even sure what that is. I need to find that out. A 1957 Chevy Barbie car for his daughter. I surprised him when I said I had one, and he sold it. Dana says there are oh so many funny calls. I wish I could remember them all. The Trading Post has always been the most fun part of my mornings on WDEV. Some great stories there. I'll tell you that when I started doing it, I thought I was calling the cows. I was supposed to be calming the cows. And I asked listeners, you know, am I doing it? How does it sound? And finally one woman said, you're scaring them. You're making them jump. 'Cause I would shout out So boss, so boss. And I was making them very nervous. They weren't given milk. I also heard from George Woodard, who said our cows are probably the oldest cows still alive in the state of Vermont that we have in the Trading Post barn. All right. Yeah, some great stuff. And I hope you'll call in and let us know some of the things you've heard, you've bought, you've sold, you've looked for as we go through this 90th year celebration. We're going to take a break for news, and then we're going to discuss archaeology in Vermont. So we'll probably have some time tomorrow, I think, as well, if you've got something to call in about with the Trading Post through all the years. Man, think if we had like charged 1%, you know, exchange fee on all the things that have traded hands through the years on the Trading Post on WDEV. Incredible. My snow tires this year that I'm going to get put on were run one season by somebody over in New York. And there's some Bridgestones that I picked up on the Trading Post. I'm going to be safe this winter because of it. All right, break for news. Come back, talk about archaeology in Vermont. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Hundreds, if not thousands of years have passed since the people who came before us lived on this land. Their possessions and settlements, and yes, their remains, have been covered over by layers of earth and sometimes development. It makes you wonder what is beneath areas that you live near or recreate on. It's these thoughts that keep our archaeologists searching for clues of where our predecessors lived and how they lived. John Kroc is a professor of archaeology at UVM and director of the Consulting Archaeology Program. He joins us now to discuss these things and share some places he and his students have made discoveries. John, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Great having you. Listeners, to ask John about the methods of archaeologists that they use or the jobs they do, you can call us 244-1777-877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. John, explain the work that the Consulting Archaeology Program does.
Sure. We do a lot of work, what's called regulatory archaeology, or in some places cultural resource management, and that entails studies that are triggered by regulatory compliance, federal and state laws that require archaeology in advance of development, much in the same way water studies or environmental studies are required before development. And it's all basically geared to making sure that as a result of federally funded or locally regulated development, rare and non-renewable resources aren't destroyed.
So who would call on you to examine possible archaeological site?
We have a range of sponsors, you know, from the Agency of Transportation to Fish and Wildlife to private developers doing a commercial development. We also work on a number of projects throughout Vermont. We've worked on a number of solar projects that have been developed that require a state permit to function. So all of these are through a regulatory process that's overseen by the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation.
And how often will this happen where you'll be called in here in Vermont?
We're pretty busy, you know, right now racing the frost-free days because our work in the field ends as soon as the ground freezes. So we're pretty busy from the spring right up until early December. And, you know, we're not the only consultant working in the state. There are also out-of-state entities that do similar work.
So, John, what you're saying is if I was really smart, I would have booked you like a month from now when you're a little less busy than today.
Well, yes. And we love projects that are planned well in advance, you know, so that we can offer some solutions. That's one good thing about the process is that, for example, in a housing development, if we found sites early on in the process, we're able to provide advice that enables those sites to be preserved within the context of the development rather than having to be in the center of an area that's going to have a house or a road or something in it.
Mm. So once you arrive at a site, what are the steps that you take to assess what has been found or what else might be present?
Well, most of it's all about sampling, and we do have kind of a predictive model where we're using environmental criteria or historic maps, in the case of historic sites, to identify areas first that are sensitive for archaeological sites. A vast majority of Vermont we could find is not sensitive based on criteria such as slope and previous development, for example. But once we get there, it's all about sampling, and so we will, for example, dig small 50 centimeter by 50 centimeter square holes at standard intervals. We use a 5 or 10 meter interval across an area that we have deemed or the state has deemed archaeologically sensitive. And then we're screening. We're doing everything by hand and screening all that material through a quarter inch or even in some cases an eighth inch mesh. So it's very tedious and time consuming, but the sampling allows us to find even small fragments of activity, whether it be Native American or early colonial sites that represent an area that we might investigate further. So this early stage, what's called phase one survey archaeology, is really looking for small fragments like the chips from the making of a stone tool, for example.
Wow. How exciting is that for you to find, or I'm thinking of your students especially, you know, the first time something shows up in that mesh as they're sifting through.
Absolutely. No, it's an exciting moment, and there come a lot of negative test pits to get to that one that has something in it. And
right.
So, you know, we had a number of students working with us this past summer, and some had worked for, you know, done a month of archaeology before they encountered an artifact. And it's all part of what we do, even when we're at a known site. A number of the sampling test pits are negative, but that helps us define activity areas and the boundaries of sites that really is important in the development process, for example, or in the process of evaluating whether a site is significant or not.
I'm not trying to be sensational, but what have been some of the most interesting or surprising things that you have discovered when you've been called to a site?
I think, you know, some of the things that interest all of us are the first sites, you know, that we found. We found evidence of the first peoples in Vermont, Native people, who were here as much as 12,500 years ago at a time when Lake Champlain was a saltwater ocean, much higher, the boundaries, the shoreline, you know, running roughly where the UVM campus is right now. And at that time, people may have entered in what is now Vermont, entered from the Champlain Seaway from the St. Lawrence River all the way from the Atlantic down into the Champlain Valley. And finding material there's a lot of trade in raw material going on. We found materials from northern Maine, material from New Hampshire, that is stone tool-making material here in Vermont, evidence that these people were highly mobile, moved around a lot, and also had, you know, very, very distant social connections.
What happens when you do find something from the first peoples of Vermont?
We, you know, it's an extensive kind of laboratory process and report writing that often takes, you know, twice or more times as long in the lab to finish up. But most of this material ends up being curated by the state in a curation facility that's now in Barrie, the State Heritage Center.
So you work closely with the state archaeologist?
Absolutely. Jess Robinson is in charge of that collection and really all things archaeological in Vermont. And we work closely with Jess and other members of the staff at the Division for Historic Preservation.
Well, John, what is known about the first peoples of Vermont?
Well, you know, one of the problems here in Vermont is we have very acidic soils, and so not a lot preserves to be studied. So we're left with stone material, for example, and later on ceramic material, clay pottery. But a lot of the things that you think about that define who people are and what, you know, what they wear and what they make, you know, wooden artifacts or textiles, those things don't preserve to be studied. And even, you know, it's hard for us to learn about what people were eating in terms of the animal kingdom. And, you know, sometimes we have rare cases where those food remains are preserved. And so we can study those to learn a little bit. But, you know, we've learned a lot about, you know, these folks were living in a, you know, the first peoples were living in a much different environment, a colder environment. And we're probably, you know, living on and potentially hunting marine mammals that would have been in the Champlain Sea, potentially even whales like the beluga whale that was found in Charlotte in the 1800s. Its skeleton is now here at UVM in the Geology Museum. We don't have any smoking gun per se of a native stone tool embedded in one of these animal bones, but we know people were here at the same time. And so I think one of the fascinating things over time is just how quickly people adapted to changing environmental conditions, adapting their technology, adapting their food, harvesting and hunting capabilities, basically to what was changing in the natural environment.
And do we have an idea of where these the first peoples lived generally in the state of Vermont?
A lot of it is, you know, based on the transportation corridors and the resource kind of concentrations that our rivers and lakes offer even today. And so these areas are highly sensitive in terms of the broad picture for archaeological sites, including those of the first people that were here. The same places you and I might want to camp today and fish were potentially, targeted by Native people as good places to camp. And we do know that throughout time, Native Americans were very highly mobile, exploiting seasonally available resources. And so we found sites in basically all locations throughout Vermont, whether it be in the lowlands of the Champlain Valley right up into the uplands.
John, how has the study of archaeology evolved as, you know, you've been involved with it?
Great question. I think, you know, we're learning a lot and using other technologies. I think archaeology has become much more multidisciplinary. There are many things that I don't know how to do, but we will engage with other specialists, for example, in the analysis of charcoal, for example, and figuring out, we work with a paleoethnobotanist, so old plants and basically the burned charcoal that we might find in a fire hearth that dates 4,000 years ago, she can analyze and identify the plant species that were being used, either those that were being consumed as food or those that were being used as firewood. And things like that and residue analysis on stone tools and things has really come a long way in working with chemists, and radiocarbon dating itself has really helped us figure out how old sites are. So it's really reaching out and using other disciplines, I think, that has been most appropriate. And also collaboration with community members and the public and working with living Native people to make sure people remember that Native Americans are still here and this is their heritage, and trying to do as much as we can to be collaborative in the process.
Let's take a call from Forbes from East Corinth. Hi, Forbes. Go right ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Is this a complimentary review, or if not, how does it come into play with the land use or a developmental situation, and how would it impact it?
It's integrated right into Act 250, our development law, so it's one of the criteria that have to be sort of checked off in the process, and that that's, again, kind of overseen by the Division for Historic Preservation. But in many cases, the archaeological work is part of the process, just like the study of wetland impacts and other environmental criteria.
John, tell us about the old Vermont graveyard site that you're moving and how you do something like that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is a graveyard that's threatened by erosion in Weybridge and eroding into the Otter Creek. And it was in use from about 1790 to 1850. And Weybridge has a deep history, like many towns of Vermont, that also includes, you know, a rich Native American history. But this is a historic cemetery, and the town has been working with the Vermont Old Cemetery Association to relocate the individuals in this cemetery to another town cemetery prior to, you know, potential erosion into the river. And so we've been working closely with the town, and you know, in this case, it's one where we wouldn't necessarily be involved. It's not our interest to work on human burials per se. That was something of the past in archaeology where it was more of a focus. But in this case, they're truly endangered, and so our work, our archaeological work, very, very carefully exhuming these individuals, learning a little bit about them in the process, and then turning them over to the town to be reinterred in another cemetery, so that no remains are lost into the river.
Mm. John, if someone is digging on their property and they do come upon what appears to be something of archaeological relevance, are they required to report it?
Not necessarily. No, I would encourage them to. I get emails all the time from folks who are trying to figure out, is this an artifact or not? And, you know, we encourage that, but also encourage folks to reach out to the state archaeologist if they do have a site. It's really more of an interest point of view as the state kind of builds out this Vermont history that goes way back 12,500 years. And remembering that these Native American sites in particular are the only record of Native American history that we have. So they're non-renewable, and as soon as one is gone, it's lost forever. And this is our window into the past. We don't have any written records of these thousands of years, for example. And so it's really important to get some information from them before they're lost. But there's no obligation unless a private landowner is involved in a development that is overseen by Act 250 or requires a development permit.
You've been involved in archaeology in Vermont going back to the mid-80s when you were a student at UVM. Do you have a pretty clear sense of what might be located where in the state?
I think somewhat, but I'm continually surprised. You know, places where I, you know, would bet that there was going to be a site, I didn't find one, and other places. We're learning and we're refining this kind of predictive model in the process, and getting better at what we do. And I'm getting better at what I do. And, you know, part of it is also judging, you know, how much time is it going to take to do something. And, you know, Vermont has a wide variety of soils from clay, which is really hard for archaeologists to work in, to sand, which is pretty pleasurable comparatively. So those kinds of things I'm learning a lot about, but I'm continually impressed. I'm continually learning more about Vermont, just going to new places across the state, which has been wonderful, particularly this time of year.
Yeah. What is an example of one of those surprises where you thought this probably wouldn't, you know, make sense in a certain spot and something was found?
I think it's those places where we find what we call stratified or layered sites. That is, sites that have been built up not only by human occupation, but also those occupations separated by flood events. And, you know, in these cases, we might be excavating through one period of history and then go down a little bit deeper and hit a buried horizon that contains something older. And those are situations where it's really impressive, and sometimes we might wish for it to be the case, but it really requires people to be camping, essentially, on the same exact place over thousands of years. And that, to me, is really cool, when you can stand in the same square foot as people have continually over thousands of years, whether it's by a river or on a prominent point overlooking the lake.
Yeah.
Those cases are really impressive, and those are places that just resonate even today as you stand there and recognize that you're not the first one to do that.
Based on something you said earlier, patience might be part of the answer for this next question. But for students considering their futures, what interests and skills would help them most if they're considering a career in archaeology?
I think you hit it. Patience is one, and I think you really need that. Some good attention to detail. We're really looking at kind of clues of the past, whether it's during excavation or in the laboratory work. But in the field work, you know, I find that people who like to be outside and don't mind a little bit of a mixture of manual labor and brain work, those people tend to do really, really well in archaeology, because we're working on in scientific methodology. But, you know, some of this work is pretty onerous in terms of the physical labor. We're working with shovels and trowels and you know, more rarely with the assistance of a machine, but usually it's pretty much a bit of a manual task.
Other than what you study here, the work you do with the CAP, what other areas of archaeology do you study?
I did my PhD work in the Caribbean, and so I dream of that, you know, on bad days here when it's cold. And I've taken students down there to work with me as well, and it's a different kind of archaeology, a kind of a different prehistory with some settlements a little bit larger and different kinds of artifacts, but it's the same, we apply the same methodologies, and it's always great to have students involved, whether there or here, even if they don't become archaeologists. I think it's a great learning process to learn the scientific method and apply these things they're learning in class to a kind of a hands-on setting.
We've got about a minute left, but is there a big find, a holy grail, if you will, that you hope to find someday either here or in the Caribbean?
I think I'm just one step at a time. I do think back to that question of those early peoples. If we found a stone projectile point or spear point embedded in a whale skeleton or a mammoth skeleton, I think that would be pretty cool. But that's yet to happen here in Vermont.
Boy, and what if you found that? What does it take to unearth something like that?
It would be a rare kind of confluence of great preservation because of the environmental conditions, and very careful excavation. I think, you know, we'd probably be dealing with fragmentary remains, if that. That's one of the downsides to working here in Vermont, is just that things don't preserve so well because our soil is so acidic, mainly because we have so much moisture out there, so much rain.
John Kroc is a professor of archaeology at UVM and the director of the Consulting Archaeology Program. John, thanks so much for being on the program this morning.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Have a great day. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we're going to be back to hear about whatever happened to Bose. And a reminder that today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Earlier this week, we heard about how Cabot Hosiery faced down moving its sock-making production offshore and developed a new and better sock, Darn Tough, that it could continue to make in Vermont. The company has continued to expand and keep jobs in the state. Today, now, we're going to learn about another Vermont family business that had to make some tough decisions, but it has meant a new direction for the company while keeping jobs right here. Many of you know Bove's, a long holdover from the old Italian neighborhood in downtown Burlington, the neighborhood that was lost to urban development. The restaurant opened on December 7th, 1941. That's right. And seemed to be kind of preserved in that time. From the menu items like the chop salad and the healthy slabs of lasagna to the mixed drinks like the Tom Collins and the Juan Collins served in juice glasses and to that quirky closing time of 8:45, the side door that you'd walk through the kitchen on your way to the dining room. And then in 2015, after 74 years, the restaurant closed and my heart sank. But Bove's is still alive, and as long as I can get the sauce, I'm very happy. Joining me now to discuss the Bove's of yesterday, today, and tomorrow is Mark Bove. Mark, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me. That was quite an introduction, and it still makes me sad. Knowing that the restaurant closed during that introduction, it made me teary a little bit.
Yeah, there were so many wonderful things. I just think about it quite often, especially when I'm in downtown Burlington and when I drive by. But describe what it was like for you growing up, having all those incredible dishes that the restaurant made there at your disposal.
I can remember my dad bringing me to the restaurant as a youngster, and I would always be fascinated going down there, and how smells just bring you back to a time. I can remember to this day in my memory, as it's just embedded in my memory, the smell of the garlic and the onions that just permeated from that concrete cement floor in the back of the restaurant. Every time you open the door, and it would get in your clothes, and it would just smell. And that memory to this day has always brought me joy, because that was a time when, Dad was with us.
So it was just
one of those things that can't wait for Dad to get home, because he would always bring us food. He would bring us the fried chicken dinner with the mozzarella and the meatballs. And it was the last thing
I had at Bove's.
My gosh.
Yeah. Oh. When did you start working in the restaurant, Mark?
So I started when I was around 15 years old. Rick, my older brother, was there as well. He started around that same time period. We both worked for about 34 years, there at the restaurant with, split shifts. And Dad started working there when he was, 13 years old. He worked for about 64 years, and that's all he knew. And Dad just cared about the neighborhood. He cared about the Marolas, the Izos, just the Lanzettas, all of those friends of his that just were in that neighborhood, Good memories.
Well, I mean, I can still picture that pasta top with all that garlic, or I would order your spaghetti with the clam sauce, and I would get it with some of the white and some of the red. Did you ever mess with or alter any of the recipes that were handed down?
Yes, I did, to be honest with you. The only one that I did not manipulate was my grandmother's marinara sauce. That marinara sauce stayed true. When I started the sauce company in 1996 on June 17th, I can even remember the day. We went down to Barrie, to make the sauces. And we used to prep all the ingredients, the garlic and the onions, bring it down in a van that we rented from Thrifty. We brought it down there, made the sauce. We made about 100 cases, and then we would drive back, and I would stop off at, you know, the Hannaford stores, and I would drop off, you know, to the Healthy Livings and the City Markets of the world, and that would last me a week, and then we would have to go back down again. I can remember the van, putting my hand on the van on the outside of the metal, and I could feel the heat from the sauce from on the side of the van because it was still warm. But getting back to it, you know, we always manufactured the sauces outside the state, and the marinara sauce was always, you know, I tried to keep it the same, but, you know, having it co-packed and made for you outside the state, you weren't really 100% sure that those contract manufacturers were making your sauces true to form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know, after that 15-year time period where I was making sauces outside the state, I actually brought it back home. And it was such a joyous thing to take that leap of faith. You know, I couldn't have done it without my brother and obviously my father and mom.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Dad has given us this legacy, and I hope I stay true to it. But, you know, the marinara sauce now is the same as it always was. It's just made in a 600-gallon kettle. And, you know, and I'm out on the floor.
Oh,
you know, I'm
wow.
out on the floor making sauce with these guys. And, you know, the fact is, you know, the other flavors that we have are rooted from the restaurant, like the mushroom and wine and the mm-hmm. garlic sauce. But, like, the vodka sauces, the cheese sauce, you know, and the Alfredo sauces, those are all sauces that are, you know, that I concocted in my head. And whether or not I woke up from a dream and say, put this and put that in it. But those were my inspirations. And so we're making those here at the factory as well.
Well, a seminal moment for Boves had to be the throwdown with Bobby Flay. So it was over lasagna. What was that like?
That was incredible. I mean, that was back in 2008, and it was mm-hmm. around October. And I remember, you know, people were like, you know, telling me who Bobby Flay was. I don't even think I even watched the Food Network until I was on the throwdown. I did not know who he was until people were starting to tell me who he was and when he came. That was a surprise for me, and to cook with a celebrity chef, that was pretty amazing, very humbling, very, very humbling. And, you know, for someone like that and for his status and in the being in the business, you know, going to chef school and all that stuff. I never went to any culinary institute.
Yep.
You know, I went to the school of Dad.
Yep.
And, you know, I may only know how to cook pasta sauce and lasagna and those Italian favorites. But, you know, since we started the factory, there's been a learning curve with me and thermal processing and cooking other items like salad dressings and barbecue sauces. And we ended up starting to cook for other people. But
yeah.
to stay on point with Bobby Flay, that was pretty cool. That kind of put us on the map. And it was exciting. It was something that I'll never forget. And I'm so glad that Dad had an opportunity to still be with us to experience that, because that was as much for him as it was for me.
And before that, Mark, wasn't lasagna just a one day a week special? I think Wednesdays, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. You got a great memory, Rick. Absolutely. Lasagna was only one day a week, and then thanks to Bobby Flay, I had to make it every day of the week.
Yes.
And oh my goodness, that was Yeah, I mean, I used to make trays upon trays every day for that, and we saw the decline in our other items go down because it was just like lasagna. That's all people wanted: lasagna, and even through the catering. So
yeah.
It was a good thing. It was all good. It was all it's all like, it was all positive vibes from people, and it was just it was great.
Mark, the decision to close the restaurant had to be a difficult one. Why was it the right one, and what did it take to convince the rest of the family that it was?
Dad was the patriarch of the family. He was the boss, and we actually made a videotape on the last days on the last months, really, closing on December 23rd, and we asked Dad repeatedly, is this what you want? Do you want us to close the restaurant down? And so we made that announcement around September of that same year. And we just wanted to make sure. We actually even videotaped them because sometimes we question ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we say, was that the right decision or whatever? But, Dad wanted us to he wanted the restaurant to be closed because one of his wishes before he passed away was, I don't share this with too many people, but it's time for people to know. Dad, one of his last wishes was for myself and Rick to have dinner with our families at night. Mm. That's one thing that he never did, that he never had. And, it was, we always had that Sunday dinner together in the afternoon. But before he passed away, he wanted us to be home, with our families. And, I have a 7-year-old and she is, I named her after my grandmother. Mm-hmm. And, thankfully Dad saw that name on that whiteboard before he passed away. And it was a hard decision.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that December 23rd was a day of just brutal emotions going through us, both Rick and myself, my staff, Martha at the restaurant, my mom. It was hard because, Dad was dying at the same token, and all those emotions of closing the doors of the restaurant for unteen years and, being all those relationships that we had with folks, I see them now and sometimes I can remember their names. Sometimes I can't, but I'll tell you 100% of the time, I know what they had. And, I could remember, oh yeah, you're the red clam sauce guy with a salad with no tomatoes, and they laugh because I can't remember their name for the life of me, but I can remember what they ordered.
Mark, that is so beautiful. Let's talk about the product line you now have. How has it expanded since you opened the plant in Milton?
So we are, we stay true to all of our sauces. I've expanded a couple flavors, like the spicy marinara. We are going to come out with a sodium-free marinara sauce that actually really tastes good without any salt. So that's going to be out next year. We're busy with the Bove's brand, but we're also busy now being that specialty packer. We are also doing contract packaging for other companies, we love it. And, I'm staying true to how I was brought up, mm-hmm. respecting people's recipes. And I mean, we even have other companies that we're making pasta sauce for that needed help with their products. And we've got sauce running through our veins, Rick.
Yeah.
And, it was a good decision. And, it was a hard decision. It was probably one of the hardest ones that Dad had to make and that we had to make. Because I'll tell you right now, If Dad said keep the restaurant going, it would still be open today.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, you know, we have a hard time letting things go. I mean, look at the restaurant. I mean, it's still erected downtown.
I know.
You know, it doesn't look like anything. You know, it's spray painted and it doesn't look the greatest. But you know, I preserve everything. I mean, I took the wallpaper, I took the neon sign, yep. I took all the booths. They're all up here preserved, you know.
Well, what's going on at the plant? Are you expanding or have you expanded?
So we have expanded. We expanded here 2 years ago. We actually had all the permits in before COVID hit. And, you know, when COVID hit, it was just like we were in the middle of our expansion. Oh, that was hell. but, you know, we got through it, and I'm glad we did, because now we have more storage. I got another kettle that we can make sauce up here, and we're only open 4 days a week up here in Milton, Monday through Thursday, because I'm kind of going back to the mantra that Dad instilled upon us, you know. Mm-hmm. Spending time with the family, that it, you know, so we're giving everybody the those 3 day weekends, and they have time to spend it with their families and have dinner with them at night, and everyone is in, you know, great moods, and they feel charged up, ready to go for the following week. But so, you know, things are good up here. You know, we're struggling with, you know, with labor, but as everyone is, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah. And where are Bove's products now available? They've got to be just about everywhere.
Well, yeah. I mean, Midwest and out west, far west is a tough reach for us. We are mainly in New England, up and down the Eastern Seaboard right now. Mm-hmm. But we also have a presence, though, in Mexico. We also have a presence in the entire country of Canada. So mm-hmm. East and West, you know, we cover that, the both Canadian coasts. So we're up there. We have a great outlet up there. And South America. So, you know, we've got some distributors that actually, you know, pick up containers here and bring our pasta sauces down to those areas. You know, who would have thought, you know, not me.
That's incredible. Mark Bove keeps the Bove's tradition alive. To learn more about all of their products, you can go to Bove's.com. Mark, it was such a pleasure having you on the show this morning. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Appreciate it, Rick.
All right. Take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Let us know who you'd like to hear or what topics. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. And it is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. Tomorrow we'll talk to the folks from Standing Trees and also hear about Vermont Works for Women, their Trailblazer program. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.